Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to Monster X Radio. It is January 19th, 2014. I'm your host, Johnny Bigfoot, and with me tonight is my co-host, Bigfoot researcher Shane Corson out of Oregon. How you doing tonight, bud?
Doing excellent, man. Glad to be here as usual, and really got a great show lined up tonight. Our guest tonight is pretty well known. Her name's Cindy Dosen. She's a BFRO investigator out of Vancouver Island. Cindy is a boots-to-the-ground researcher with a lot of experience and is highly respected amongst the Bigfoot community and elsewhere, and I respect her highly myself. Been following her for a number of years. And Cindy also believes she was chased by a Sasquatch. And just recently, as of this weekend, was out in the field and had some going-ons out there that I'm sure we will discuss tonight. But let's just get right to the show and our guest, Cindy Dosen. Glad to have you here, Cindy.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing great. Doing great. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Really appreciate it and really, really happy to have you here.
Well, thank you for asking me to come on. Enjoy sharing my experiences with other people so they can have, you know, some positive experiences as well.
Absolutely.
Or carry one.
Yeah, your experience is one of the more hairy and scary ones that, you know, that's out there, and especially ones
don't
that I've
read.
Don't
go alone, huh?
Yeah.
But,
it is.
So, you know, I got a lot to talk about tonight. I guess, you know, I kind of want to start out with, you know, what kind of got you into the research field and what got you involved with the BFRO?
Well, I got involved with the field basically from the experience I did have and wanted some questions because I couldn't fathom what happened to me. It didn't make any sense. And so when I finally, in a sighting report, and not really a report, but just a question to the BFRO because it was the only site I found, and asked them, is this a movie set or does this kind of stuff happen? So I sort of wrote what happened, and I got a phone call right away from an investigator on the island, and he come down and talked to me and so on and so forth, and we went over the areas and stuff. But it just, that's what got me interested at first, because I just lost all my confidence to go out in the woods, and I like to hunt. So I needed some answers, and like everybody else on the other side of the fence, I didn't believe in them. I didn't think it was true, and, you know, all of a sudden you run into something that, you know, is very questionable. You need to sort of figure out what's going on. And that's how I became involved with this.
Excellent, yeah.
What year was that?
That was in 2007. I went on an expedition we had on the island here as a liaison to the area to show the investigator and Matt and Cliff and Bobo and Wally come over and stuff. And at the time, I wasn't involved with the BFRO. I knew very little of it. And at the end of it, I was asked to be an investigator, just, I guess, because to keep an eye on the areas and stuff and reports coming in for them. So that was the start of it.
What exactly were you doing out in the woods that day when it happened?
When it happened, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I used to be one of these people that would go on the internet looking for the weird and unusual things, you know, like I wanted to read up on Jack the Ripper and just weird stuff for whatever reason. And I come across the Sasquatch thing and thought, you know, oh yeah, whatever. I remember this as a kid when the Patterson-Gimlin thing kind of came all over the place. I lived in Alberta and they were going on about footprints and all that. And that was a little bit of it. And then I sort of typed in Sasquatch and Bigfoot for giggles and shits. And, you know, I came across this site down, I think, in Georgia because it had photos. And I'm going, okay, let's see what this photo thing's about. And they're going, this is a tree structure. This is X marker. This is what they kill. This is this. And I'm looking at it all, and I'm living in B.C. now, and I'm going, what, are they kidding me? That's just all wind stuff blowing down. What the hell are they on? And that was it. And I didn't pay much attention to it for months. And then when I was out going to our farm and we drove down this road, I was looking in the woods as we're driving, and all of a sudden I seen something that I recognized from this website as being an X marker. And I'm going, no, not really. So a couple days later, I was heading out to the farm, and I thought, I'll just jump in the woods with my camera and go take a look, just because I didn't believe in it. I just want to know why they thought that would be an X marker and this looks similar, right? And I got in there and looked at stuff, and I was going up a deer trail. And there were some other things that they were talking about, archers and bows being held down by different trees and so on. And I was kooking around in there and taking pictures. It was kind of a really, it was April 2nd, 2007, and I won't forget it. It was like a little after 12 noon. It was a rainy, drizzly day, but just a light drizzle, but it was very gray and overcast. And when I was in there for about 20 minutes maybe, I was heading back out of the woods, and all of a sudden these two deer came up this game trail I was following, and it was really weird because when they came running up the trail, I was just off it by maybe 10 feet, they kept run by me, like right by me. I could have reached out and touched them. They were not afraid of me being there, which was really odd, but their inner ears were pinned back. They were more worried about what was chasing them, and I thought, oh my God, it must be a cougar coming, and I thought, this is not good. I better get out of here, or I'm going to be lunch instead of them, or something's going to happen. So I quickly darted out back out to the road I came in on, but I was following along this trail, and went down an embankment, and I was back out onto this road. And all of a sudden, just as I jumped down onto the road, right across the road, this gravel sprayed across, and all I seen was this black, round shape thing, and it would have been, I thought, was a bear bum at first. And it must have startled when it seen me jump out of the woods and ran down this embankment. The thing is, this embankment is almost in an 80-degree angle, and it's about 20 feet down. When I seen this black shape, now it would have been like a bear bum with an unusual bump, maybe like the hunch of the back, the arch of the back, and then a bum. Reason why I'm saying bear is because that was my first instinct, thinking that that was a bear. So I ran up the road thinking it was a bear with cubs, because that's usually what's out in springtime, you know, but it was odd that they were chasing deer. It just didn't make any sense. But
yeah.
I ran down the road to my right, heading north to power lines. And I ran up there thinking, okay, this bear is going to leave because I don't want to be in the way. When I'm running, I can hear something down in the bush and, you know, crunching around and thrashing. And I thought, oh, man, she's running the other way. Good. But this thing started yelling at me. And it was like a yell, scream, roar, all in one vocalization. And it was like, "Wah!" And I thought it was very odd because I've never heard that before at all in the daytime. And there's, you know, farms around. And I'm going, what the heck? And I'm running, like I'm scared running because I don't even know what's going on. I thought, man, this bear is really pissed. And I ran under the power lines, and this thing screams, this yell, scream, roar at least 10 or 12 times by that time, because I'm like counting, and it's just not shutting up. And I thought, frig. And I jumped into the bush thinking, if I hide from this thing, it's going to shut up and get its babies out of the tree, and it's going to go the other way. Maybe it felt it was being encroached on, or it was being, you know, cornered. And I thought, I'll just be quiet and let it go, and everything will be fine. And I'm standing there, and all I got with me is my camera around my neck. That is it, because I was out taking pictures, right? I didn't have my bear spray or anything like that. And this thing continued on, and it continued on, and there is a low brush that grows underneath the power lines once it's been, you know, cut back and regrown. This brush that there is now about 10 feet tall. And all I can see is this brush moving forward and back, like something big behind it is pushing this bush, like, immensely. You know, it's not a little skinny branch bush. You know, they're 2-inch diameter limbs on this bush. Like, it's thick brush. And I can't see anything, and I'm like, oh, and I'm standing behind the tree trying to hide behind the tree as much as possible, and it finally went quiet. Hang on, okay.
So and you're alone at this point, huh?
I'm alone. I'm all by myself,
mm-hmm.
waiting for this thing to leave. And if you know, it may have been about 3-4 minutes, but it felt like a half an hour, if not longer. You know, this thing was so loud. I could feel it vibrate through my chest, just like a big speaker at a concert. You could feel it. And none of this was making any sense to me. I know that we don't have moose on the island and stuff. Like, nothing that big makes that kind of a sound that I could recognize. Like, you could feel
right.
it. And I then decided it was gone because everything was quiet. I jumped back out onto the road, and I was going to go back. And the thing started yelling at me again and breaking trees, and it sounded like 2x4s getting broken there. It was just like World War II. Somebody breaking trees and stuff in there. I couldn't believe it. And this yell, scream, roar. And I went back into the bush, and I'm hiding it behind this tree, and I'm thinking, I'm so screwed. I took my camera off my neck and wrapped it in my hand with the strap around it. That's my only weapon. If it's going to come up after me, then that's all I got to beat it on the head with or in the nose or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And another minute went by, and it went quiet. And this time I thought it left because there was no smashing of the trees, nothing. It was, like, dead quiet. So I come back out onto the road. Now, I come back out on the road because I have to run back past where this thing was because my car was in the opposite direction that I came from, and that's not good. So I... That was the bad part, and I'm going, okay. So I went across the side of the road, and I ran as fast as I could down the shoulder of that road to get to my car. And this thing down there didn't start screaming again, but it never left. But it was starting to break bigger trees, like big limbs. It was just the amount of noise. It was just crazy, like somebody had a baseball bat. And I was running, and this thing was paralleling me down in this
ravine or
gorge or something. Yeah, it was down there, and it was probably, you know, 10 feet behind me, the noise. And when I was running, this thing was, yeah, like it was hurting me along with all this noise until I got into my car, and it went quiet. Now, I know for a fact that bears don't do that. They don't sound like that, and they don't do that. If you give them a way out, they're gone. This was not a bear. This black, round thing was not a bear. And when I got home, my husband was here, and I was snow white in the face, and I was crying, and he was quite astounded because I'm not that kind of girl. I'm a little more tough and not so frilly around the edges. And and for me to be white and crying, he said, I must have had a good scare. And I told him what happened, and he just looked at me, and he says, be careful what you look for. And I said, no. But I couldn't accept it. I just couldn't accept it. Like, it scared me that bad. And I went on the Internet as soon as I got home looking for sounds. And I finally found one with all these animal recordings on there, trying to figure out what this sounded like to make sure, you know, it wasn't an animal like an elk or something. I don't know.
Yeah, known to the area.
I was trying to reason, be reasonable with this. And the best I could come up with was an African lion, a grizzly bear, and a gorilla doing this roar at the end. So if you blended the three together in the three stages, that's what it was. We don't have grizzly until the last couple of years. They've had a few spotted, but not down at this end. We definitely do not have African male lion, and we certainly don't have any gorillas here. And I was beside myself, and that sound today is still in my head. I hear it, and it I've never heard it again out in the field. I've heard parts of what it sounded like out in the field, but I've never heard that identical yell, scream, roar. And that's how I explain it, because it was very pitchy, and all. But it was very barrel-chested. It had a large chest to be able to produce that kind of sound with that kind of vibration, and it was just resonating. It was crazy. And I needed answers, and I thought for sure that this was, you know, I just thought it was movie set, because it was just like, how does this happen? You go out looking for a picture because you thought you seen something, and then you run into the damn thing? Like, how, you know, this just, it just doesn't make sense. But that was what happened. And to this day, I still think that this how it was Sasquatch related, because nothing else could fit into that slot for me. Nothing. I know what I seen, I know what I heard, and the whole presence of the deer, the way they were acting, and it just, you know, nothing was adding up to what we have on the island here as far as game. And, yeah.
Cindy, you mentioned something interesting with the power lines. Well, I got two questions, kind of a double-sided question here. Now, you mentioned that you were near power lines, and you mentioned the deer. Do you think the power lines played a role, and do you think that you possibly, why this possible Sasquatch word at you, do you believe that possibly you broke up a hunting scenario?
Yeah, the power lines there, you know, now that I've been with the BFRO for a length of time now, probably 6 years, power lines are used as a corridor for most game animals and predator animals because it's easy traveling. So these power lines, yeah, they could have been easily, they've been traveling along there, and you know, it's got, you know, grass and stuff that's available to the sun, so they have a wider
exactly.
range of feed for them and to travel. And I really do think that I did intercept something chasing these deer. My husband came out with me several weeks later, and we went looking over the area because I wouldn't go by myself. I just, there's no frickin' way. This just was not going to happen, but I needed answers, and he didn't believe, so he said, oh, I'll go in, and so I sort of hung close to him and stuff, and we went in, and we did find some stuff that they said were like X markers and tree twists and stuff, but, you know, at the time, it didn't make, you know, mean much to me at the time, in a sense, but I did
right.
take photos and stuff, and my husband was just gallivanting around in there like nothing happened, and we didn't find much of anything, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It just the game trails through there are phenomenal, and there was a creek down at the bottom of this little ravine, and that's how we knew the steepness of the embankment. So when I think back of it now, doing more details for investigations and you know, hypotheses and physics, that enabled me to see that part of the black thing, it had to have been at least, you know, 5 or 6 feet tall to even see that part of it. Because it's like a sheer drop down there. So there was no way, if that was a bear, I would have never seen nothing of the bear at all. So, and that was the other thing, that this thing was taller than the average animal that I knew. And
land typically used for that you were on? Is it used for any recreation or hunting or anything?
No, it's just a parcel of land. There's a farm on... a blueberry farm, probably about a half a kilometer away.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, and I think the deer go in there in free range on some of that. And then there's, like I said, there's a creek down there. It's quite nice. It's old growth fir and stuff down there. And then the road goes through into a town. And on the other side, where about another half, about a quarter of a kilometer, is a kind of a small cattle farm. So I'm thinking that the deer go in there and eat off the hay fields and that. And then right there is a great big mountain. It's called Maple Mountain. And they've just started letting them use that. You can go in and horseback ride and bike ride in there on old logging roads. But that's just in the last year or two. So it's basically just all forested and mountains and the odd farm here and there. So
I find the power lines link kind of interesting just because what you had mentioned before, that, you know, I was talking to Cliff Brockman one day about this, about how the forest, it's hard for the sun to penetrate the forest, and so there's a lack of food, especially grass growing.
Yes.
You get into these clear cuts where the sun is penetrating and the grass is, you know, can be abundant. And that's where you get a lot of foraging. And it only makes sense that a predator would be, say, in the forest bordering those areas hunting.
Yes. That would make sense. And this, like I said, there's like blueberry farm and then other types of little farms in between. It was perfect. And it was nice and cool when you got in the ravine because these trees are so big and old, the canopy makes it nice and cool. So, you know, if they're hot, plus there was fresh water running through there but not too intrusive, and there was a lot of big old cedar trees and where the boughs touch the ground, so it would be perfect to keep you dry underneath some of these dry beds and stuff, right?
Right.
And, yeah, it totally caught me off guard. Now, sheesh, I'm just waiting for that to happen. Good Lord.
Well, yeah. Are we all? But, I mean, at the time you were, you know, petrified,
I was a skeptic, and I had no knowledge and no experience whatsoever. It just was the very little, you know, I happened to wander on a site out of a whim one day and just happened to remember these funny little pictures, right? Other than that, I had nothing to do with this at all when that happened. It just was, yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, if I was not such an outdoors person, I think that would have left me traumatized and I would have stayed at home. I would have never gone camping for the rest of my life.
I want one of those moments. <With friends. laughs>
My husband says, be careful what you ask
you
for.
Yeah. And you probably felt a bit of danger and you felt obviously fear and whatnot.
Yeah.
Looking back, do you think you were in danger at all?
I think it was more, now when I look back, I would say it was more, it was trying to scare me away. Like everything it was doing was like bluffing, right? It was making lots of noise and not showing itself. It was thrashing the bushes. It was making, you know, vocalizations, yet it wasn't hunting me down. It wasn't charging me. It was actually following me around, which made me very suspicious, right? That is not the same bears do. They run one way and you run the other. You know, I've had run into bears, and that's what they do.
Yeah.
They don't yell at you and all that kind of stuff. They just, you know, they make a lot of noise when they take off the other way, but they don't follow and they don't hang around waiting for you to come back out after you, you know. This thing was adamant that I needed to leave, and this is what was going on. Yeah.
And there's a lot of, I read a lot of encounter reports, interviewed people that have had similar scenarios, not quite that intimidating, but where they felt that they've been bluff charged, you know, something trying to scare him out of the area. You know, there's I read a couple of really good encounters in Washington where there's guys up there hunting and they see these deer just run right by them, not even paying attention to them, running, you know, and, you know, come across either a Sasquatch or what they believe to be a Sasquatch. So, and basically the same sort of scenario, screaming at them, yelling at them, you know, trying to just scare them off, you know, and maybe a little peeved off that they ruined their hunt.
Well, an animal that size must expend a lot of energy when they do go on a hunt. So, you know, it's like, you know, some, you know, like tigers and that, they have the infrasound through the throat and they use that as a hunting technique because they don't have, there's a big cat, they don't have a lot of energy to expend between meal to meal. So, you know, Mother Nature has given them tools to use to help that. And I'm sure this animal must be, you know, it's fairly big and fast, but I'm sure it must have, you know, it has to catch something when it does use its energy. And when you ruin it, I would be peed off too if somebody promised me prime rib roast and all I got was a hot dog.
Yeah.
But I look at it now that even it took me the longest time to even acknowledge that, because I wouldn't tell anybody about it. I wouldn't talk about it. I just chalked it up as a really weird experience and just kept it in the closet for the longest time until some of the investigators on the island started leaking it out to other people and stuff. And I shared with the odd person, but just on the QT. And now having my own experiences and doing investigations and talking to people, I look now and saying, yeah, I had a lot of indicators going on there that this would be very Sasquatch related. Absolutely.
Now, with Vancouver Island, I mean, let's talk a little bit about Vancouver Island in general. I mean, it has a rich history of sightings. From what I can gather, it goes back almost 200 years. It's not as if this is a recent event. I mean, there's a lot of reports, like I said, going back, a couple hundred years.
Yeah, a lot of the, First Nations storytelling and the folklores and the totems, they all have this included in part of their history. The wild woman of the woods or the whistling woman, they have the wild man of the woods or the buckwhis, and here in Cowichan Valley they call it the thumquis. Up and down the island they have different names, but all for the same the creature looks the same in their artifacts, such as the totems. It always is got the long hair, and the lips are big and red and very pursed, like it's whistling, and kind of very stocky looking as far as their masks and petroglyphs and stuff look like. So, yeah, I believe it's got a rich history. The closest spot of Vancouver Island to the mainland is up by Campbell River, which is northern of the on the island here, and it's probably a mile across. But it's very treacherous because of the flooding tides and stuff like that. There's whirlpools and stuff in there, so to swim across that would be insane. And small crafts very seldom go through there because it's so torrent. But the bigger ships, cruise ships and stuff, can go through there. It's deep in there too. But they have, like I said, grizzly bears have known to come onto the island up through there, but they're usually destroyed right away because they're not part of the ecosystem here. And so there wouldn't be enough to support them, if they come over here. So every once in a while we've had, reports that they've been putting one down here and there.
Yeah.
But,
I was going to say, and the island, it's not a small island. I mean, I think it's 32,000 square kilometers. And from what I read, it's about the size, it's comparable to the Netherlands. It's a really large island.
Yes, it's very long. It's if you went from one end to the other, it's about an 8-hour drive, and to go across it's at least 4 hours. So it's long and narrow, but it's got two big mountain ranges on it, glaciers. The weather here, is mild most of the time. Like our winter, we've had one day with snow, and it was about 2 to 3 inches, and by the next day, it's gone. So most of our climate here is more wet and just above freezing, and that would be the coldest time of the year. But other than that, it's, fairly lush in the sense. What can I say? We do have a limited variety of animals that do live on the island, such as the elk. The Roosevelt elk were actually brought over here by the government in the 1970s. To introduce more game on the island. We have the little Sitka black-tailed deer that you have in California. We got those little guys. Those are native. We got Pacific black bear, which is native to the island. They're a little different. They're a bigger black bear, and they don't hibernate. They're generally between 600 to 700-pound range. They're a bigger type of black bear. We have one of the densest populations of cougar in North America is on Vancouver Island. We have
same with the bear.
We got a fairly hefty population of bear. Yeah. But we've got a lot of shellfish that's available. The different variety of berries and moss but those are the only two ungulates that we have on here. Is the elk and the deer, and then we have the two predator animals and some wolf.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have coyotes, and we don't have skunk, We don't have possum. There's a few things that we do not have that comes from the mainland, badgers or any of that stuff we don't have here. Poisonous snakes, there's no poisonous snakes here.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching a very interesting video about the wolf population on the island and how brazen they were. I saw a video where they were actually chasing a large black bear on the island.
And yet they're a smaller wolf compared to the timber wolf. They're just a gray wolf, a Pacific gray wolf, yeah. But I haven't seen any. I haven't heard any. I've heard one cougar, and I haven't seen any cougar. I've seen elk, seen black bear, lots of black bear. So the animals we do have here, it's, you know, you don't get to see them very often, yet we've got, like I said, one of the densest population of cougar. So, you know, seeing a Sasquatch is about the same rate as seeing a cougar. But
yeah.
I would say that we have, if we've got a heavy population of Sasquatch here, so they must, you know, the gene pool, I don't know if they come back and forth, but there must be a fairly different gene pools available so they don't become too interbred, kind of speaking. But I do know on the island, compared to other places I've been to, that they are more vocal here than they are just about anywhere else. If they're around, they're going to vocalize. And it's, they don't do a lot of tree
hopping.
What
do you guys have for cities?
Cities? We got
how's the human population there?
Victoria is the biggest city, and that's right at the south tip of Vancouver Island, and it's right across from the Olympic Peninsula in Washington, like as the crow flies across the water or directly across from there. We have one other city that's about Nanaimo, and I'm only guessing about 150,000. And we have small towns, you know, up and down the island and stuff. So the whole corridor of the middle of Vancouver Island is non-populated. It's privately owned by a timber company, and it has limited access. They don't allow people in there. So there is, you know, hundreds and hundreds of square miles in the interior of the whole island that has no human contact other than a logging truck going through there.
Where do most of the encounters take place? In the heavily populated areas or the not-so-populated areas?
Well, I think due to the access, we have them more closer to populated areas. I live in Duncan, which is Couch and Valley, and they've had lots of sightings in the Couch and Valley and around, up on the mountains on either side. And so they're right on the fringe of, you know, human contact. So I always refer to that as more semi-rural domestic, and that's, I think, because they use the opportunity of getting food such as, you know, gardens and apples and animal food, horse food, dog food, or even, you know, small cats and stuff. But, you know, coming in with range of the city, I would say that they're still easily, you know, a couple miles as to where they would come to and not come to, right? But, there's lots of vegetation in between every little town and stuff, you know, that I don't think the animal would feel encroached on. It would just go through the area.
Right. If you don't mind giving up your age here, one of the questions we had was, you know, how old were you when you had your initial encounter?
I was
generalization.
You can lie on this one. Okay, I'm 54 now, so we take off 6 years. So I would have been 48.
<All right.
laughs> I wasn't young. I could still run.
Is that spot where you had your encounter, has there been other sightings in that area?
Not reported, but I have talked to a local gentleman that used to hunt up on that mountains, and he was in his 60s, and he's had, in his younger days, he had an occasion where he thought he was being followed, and he put it down to being cougar, but he said that what it was doing was not acting like a cougar. It was making way too much noise and stuff, very questionable stuff, and that's the same mountain that I had on. So, you know, and he was not associated with any of this. He was actually dropping a parcel off at the house, and he seen my Jeep, and I have a big Bigfoot field researcher on the side of the window on the Jeep with a native Sasquatch decal on there. And I get a lot of people that will come up to me and look at me and say, "You actually do that?" And I do. It opens up to them, "Well, I had this happen to me, but my husband thinks I'm crazy," or, "I've never told anybody because it's been 50 years ago, but I know what I seen that day." And so it's a really good groundbreaker for people that want to talk, but they don't know who to go to. And yeah, some of them don't use the internet, or some of them will get on there, but they have no idea where to go on the internet to do this, and they're not sure if it's going to be confidential. And you get a lot of people that are very apprehensive about talking about what has happened to them or what they've seen, just from the general public over the years of, you know, the way they, you know, treat people, kind of.
Yeah.
But
I was going to say, like Derek Randall said, you know, there's two types of people. There's those that, once they have an encounter, go out of their way to try and find somebody to report this to or talk about it. And there are those that don't talk about it, but it changes their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I've run into a lot of people who got, and it's really helpful for me with the First Nations. They come up to me and approach me to tell me their story, rather than you going to them, because a lot of them won't talk about it because it's, you know, it's bad luck, it's an omen, you know, be afraid of it. That's what they're taught. And I find that with, you know, First Nations people or Native people from all different areas, you know, Alberta, BC, down in the States, it's the same thing. They've always been told that it's not a nice thing to be near or have an event with, right? You're
mm-hmm.
to respect it and leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
So I get a lot of them coming up to me now and saying, "Well, this did happen, and it's been down there for a while," and it kind of just, I have a big valley map where I start plotting out all these little sightings and stories from, and whether it's, you know, conclusive or not, a lot of these people, when they had their experience, there was no internet available. There was very little movies or no movies that was even created on the monster. I mean, we're talking back in the 40s and in the early
yeah.
50s. These people had no media experience or to come up with this kind of stuff.
Yeah, to compare,
you know,
something to, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I give them a lot of a credence to that because they weren't influenced by something. And you know, you're talking to a 70-year-old man that's shaking his boots and is like, you know, having to give up his one thing in life, and that's being a man, to tell you a story that this just about, you know, put him in tears and crapped his pants, you know. You got to give, you know, the guy some leeway, you know, that he's telling you the truth, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically, your encounter is what led you to the BFRO, which
yeah.
led you to become a member and an investigator for them.
Yeah, 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 and I'm still doing it all the time. It's kind of like you get your teeth sunk into it, and you're not willing to let go yet. I'm not satisfied enough of what I experienced and seen and heard for me to give it up yet. Not yet.
Nice.
Yeah.
Left you wanting more.
Yeah, it's Easter egg hunt for adults, and I'm a curious person, so I will continue on till
year-round,
you know,
Easter egg hunt.
Yeah, and that's how I put it, because you don't know where to look. I mean, you can go to areas that have, you know, rich history of sightings, and you don't know if they're in the area right now, or do they come through there in different times of the year, which, you know, I find when I was watching a nest area, for 3 months, nothing happened. Nothing was added. Nothing, the bedding was not disturbed. Nothing. And then 6 months down the road, all of a sudden there was things starting to notice. So they must, like the circle of life in Africa, I really believe that they have a very wide spectrum of area that they sort of travel through, and maybe at 3-month intervals and 4-month intervals that they eat whatever's available there and then move on, so they don't over graze a certain, you know, area. You know, some people say they follow the herds. Yeah, I believe they do, but they couldn't follow the same herd all the time, or they wouldn't have anything left. But, you know, it's a big animal. It needs a lot of resources. You know, I do believe they stay in a vicinity of probably 50, 60 miles, but you just don't know where they're going to be in that 50, 60 miles. It's still a needle in a haystack, you know. So
yeah, and that's why I find Vancouver Island so awesome, because, you know, there's a lot of debate about migration or you know, all these scenarios. But Vancouver mm-hmm. Island, I mean, really, migration, what does that mean? You know, I mean, there would be no
migration here, because the temperature on the island, for the most part, up and down, is the same for the most part, within, you know, 5 degrees.
Yeah.
You know, and where are you going to migrate to? 100 miles
yeah.
down the island and then migrate back up for whatever reason? So migration, I don't believe, is part of the thing here. I do believe they stay in their general vicinity, and the males, I think, sort of wander that perimeter, and how the family units stay more put, and they move in smaller increments. And I believe they're territorial, and that's probably what happened to me. It was either a young male that was kicked out of the family or something,
uh-huh.
and started on his own, and he was scared and I was scared. You know, I think if it was an older male, a more distinguished older male, I don't think it would have carried on like it did.
Right.
I think this was a younger one. It was a little full of himself, and he was hungry, because it was probably just him.
and possibly his territory.
In his territory that he finally established, yeah. Yeah.
So you say there's power lines by there?
Yes. Yeah.
The power line thing is interesting to me, because what do power lines give off? What, radiation or electromagnetic fields? And I've
mm-hmm.
wondered what kind of effect that would have on animals and animal behavior.
Well, I know when you stand under them yourself, you can kind of hear them humming and that, and it gets
yeah.
to be annoying after a while, you know. And I know
yeah.
that here the vegetation does not grow as nice as it does on the sidelines. So obviously, like you said, there is something to do with the radiation that stunts the growth and stuff under there. So I think that when they do go use the power lines, it's for a short-term you know, whether they're walking
mm-hmm.
down a trail and then going into the bush, or they're, you know, for them to stand out in there and graze all day, I think they would pretty well chop their ears off. It would be too much. But I think it is you know, power lines are miles and miles and miles long, and it's so they can move through different areas in a quicker period of time, you know, that they need to, like through the seasons, rather than struggling every day trying to go from one end of the, you know, to the for summer up and down the mountains and so on. But yeah.
Cindy, through your research over all these years and different encounters, have you developed any patterns? I mean, what times of year for you would you consider to be a hot time of year to maybe have an encounter or do research? And you know, what do you look for?
Personally, I think the better time of the year is usually around September and October and November. You know, some of the babies are, you know, the deer and the elk are coming down and staying lower. So, you know, the salmon are running then. We have different, you know, I think August the sockeye runs, and then later on September I think the big silvers and stuff run. And then in the winter in December, we get a lot of the chum that come up and into the rivers and run. So, you know, through the colder months, that's when a lot of this, you know, extra resources come available, right? And the berries ripen in September and October, and the mushrooms. And so I think that's when we get more, that's when I get a better response if they're out there. And they just seem to answer us more. And I just wandered off there for a second. What I look for, and I usually go on the maps and Google Maps, I look for, like a lot of researchers will go for a lake or a river, a good water source.
Yep.
So you look at that. You look at the amount of disturbance that's, you know, if it's freshly logged or if it's hardly been logged or it's growing up, you know. I look for stuff that's away from human activity as much as possible, just because you want some credibility. If you do get a recording, you want to make sure that it wasn't some pack of kids answering you or fooling around or somebody shooting a gun. And so I do that. I try to go out of my way to make sure that we get a place, a nice valley that's a dead-end valley or a confluence of valleys, because if you get a nice long corridor valley that will go 20, 30 miles, that valley is just used by more game, right? It's
mm-hmm.
a long
yeah.
stretch. It's easy to travel through. So I look for those as well. And I don't think the rain has that much of a difference on them. The rainy seasons, they seem to look for wet areas. And I think it's because the lichens on the tree and the moss and that is maybe another food source that they use. Some of the areas have more medicinal plants that grow in some of these areas, you know, such as like the lily roots or, you know, the devil's club grows in a very lush, wet, and quite shaded areas of the forest. And the devil's club root is used even in our society for, you know, arthritic purposes and stuff like that. So I think that's what I look for.
And have you developed any certain patterns with your research?
As in, like...
With the amount of encounter reports that you've investigated with the BFRO, I mean, is there certain patterns that you think Sasquatch does? I mean, you do a lot of research out in the field yourself.
Yes.
Is there anything that you've come to think that Sasquatch do on a regular basis?
Going through a lot of the reports and stuff and going on my own expeditions and stuff, one thing I've been working on is a lot of the time they say they don't see Sasquatch due to the full moon because they can see you and go, so on and so forth. Well, as a big game hunter, I know that most of your ungulates and that will feed on a full moon because it's very bright out. They can see, and yet they're quite hidden from a lot of the, like, the bear and the cougar. So they seem to sleep all day and feed at night, and that's the opportunity for the Sasquatch. I like the full moon because it's easier on my eyes. But I also know, due to our human nature, that full moon affects us, and anything that has, you know, water in the body, it all affects us. We're easily irritated and more testosterone, so eager to confront or to fight. And if you got animals moving around, so there, I would think myself, I use that as to be more confrontational with them. I get more aggressive on the calls. I will position people at different areas on a valley, you know, two up top on either side and one down below, and we'll reenact like a mating situation as I get a male to put out a sort of a male call looking for a female escort or a female, and then I'll get a girl to immediately answer him with a good scream saying, "I'm over here," kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we wait another minute or 2 minutes, and I'll have an older gentleman get them to do a male call, a deep one, saying, "This is my valley," and in when you scream it in that sense, like, you know, think about, you know, challenging the young man for the young woman you just heard. And we've done that scenario, and we've gotten a lot of reactions out of that, doing that. And I think just because everybody is agitated, and I just think that they're more up to listening because they're already out there hunting. That's one of my things that I try. Yeah,
I'm really glad you brought that up, because it was a question I posted in a lot of the Facebook groups about the full moon. I wanted to get people's responses, especially researchers and people on the field, on what they thought the full moon as far as researching or going out. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? And I think the majority of people agreed that full moon's a good thing. You know, when I've gone out on a full moon, you know, a lot of times I've gotten great responses and a lot of activity, you know, and a lot of people think, oh, because it's a full moon, Sasquatch won't go out because the light. But like you said, it plays a big role, not just with humans, but with animals as far as behavior. And I think the full moon is a great time to go out, if you're especially looking for an encounter or possible evidence.
Yeah. And those are kind of things thinking out around the box. You know, don't be the cookie cutter follower. Think of what as yourself as in a person, or, you know, how things work in life, what, you know, how we operate, and put that out in the field. Like, you know, look at it from the Sasquatch's eyes or from a wild human's eyes out there, as how they are affected by things. You know, you want to get to the places where it's most abundant berries. Our vision is limited due to the fact that we've been domesticated over the years to TVs and house lights and so on. If we were out in the wild, where would we be? You know, how would you utilize that? For me, the full moon, yes, it's a better, like I said, you have more options of using that to your advantage and instigating, you know, response and so on. I also noted that on our database that a lot of the reports, and you go over the years of the reports and the times of years and when certain things have happened, I've noted that a lot of the sightings and the vocalizations and more aggressive behavior was always the night or two before a full moon or just after a full moon. So then I started using that to my advantage. I want to go out there and press some buttons because I want you to yell at me. I want you to come and see what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a little more successful. So these are some of the things over the years from my experiences in that unfold. There are patterns coming. You just got to start putting the data down and researching. Even if you get stories from people, I always ask, when was it? And they go, I don't know. I said, was there leaves on the trees or were they naked? You know, stuff like that. So you start to get a season, and, you know, and were you hungry? Was it supper time or lunchtime, you know? You'll start getting these patterns from even just people that you run into. Like I get the people that come up to me and all these little details gives me the, you know, the time. And you can go on the Farmer's Almanac and, you know, check out the seasons of history. You know, what was it like that day? Go back and check, see where the moon was. You know, you can get all that history on the almanac, right? And those all come into to factor that, gee, it was a full moon when that happened 50 years ago, and it happened, you know, a mile up the road, you know, 2 years ago around the same time. So there's another pattern arising then. Maybe every year this animal seems to be in this area in this month of June, right?
Yeah.
Around that time. So those are just, you know, all the little details that people, when they go out and do this, you know, start writing it down and research. It'll come out. It'll, you know, that's some of the stuff that I do is try to eliminate the big area and sort of pinpoint things down to a little more specific time, specific area. I recently got involved in doing like with rock and, you know, your geography and then, you know, your terrain. What has the terrain got to offer? And I started reading about volcanic rock because you hear a lot of the stories from, you know, Mount St. Helens and Mount Baker and, you know, Mount Adams, Mount Rainier, all those areas where we get a lot of occurrence or they're still occurring, you know, that this volcanic rock has a high count of natural occurring salts and other like magnesium and stuff in them. So they're easy to access because it's already been brought up through the ground for them. And I'm starting to work on that could be a feature too, is start paying close attention, you know, go back through some history and see, these are they close to volcanic? Or you can go on, I know in Canada, our government has the geological minerals and lands information where you can go in there and it'll show you what types of rock is where, and you can see the, you know, where the divides come through, where the rock has changed and the sediments, and so you can start pinpointing that into your data as well, you know, where your deer winter feed grounds are. Is there a volcano near there? Is there, you know, this and that? And all of a sudden, you're starting to get a smaller and smaller area that have a higher probability of maybe getting something out of it as Sasquatch related. It's just that everybody has to share their data and kind of, you know, get this down.
Cindy, we're going to take a quick break here, but, you know, you're touching upon some of the many things I've been questioning people on lately, especially with the rocks and whatnot. These are questions I want to get back to, especially on patterns and whatnot, after the
mm-hmm.
break. And we'll take a few calls. But, Johnny, let's take a quick break here and get back with Cindy Dosen and carry on.
All right.
All right.
Thank
sounds
you.
Good. with Cindy Dosen.
Hello.
Hello. Hey, you know, this is a great show so far. I'm really stoked. I've learned a lot from you, Cindy, and some of the stuff that you brought up tonight has been on my mind recently, you know, both with the full moon and the moon cycles and whatnot, and also rocks and encounters around rocky areas, you know, not to be confused with cairns or cairns, rock piles, but areas with rocks. In an area that I research in, there is about 5 lakes, and each one of these lakes has an area, usually on the southeast side of the lake, with it kind of looks like a rock slide, a lot of volcanic, also, you know, granite, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But that's where a lot of the encounters seem to come around, not just, you know, not just rocks being thrown, not just rock clanking, but a lot of the encounters seem to be around these rock areas, you know. And I called up Derek Randall's last week and asked, you know, because I want to learn. I have so many questions. And one of the questions, I asked him about these, you know, what's your thoughts? And, you know, and he had said that something that I thought I would have thought of, but I didn't, but that a lot of the a lot of these rocks actually provide game trails across these rocks, you know. In these areas that I'm talking about, it's pretty steep. The rocks go, you know, quarter mile up the hill or mountain. And, you know, he'd mentioned that a lot of hunters use those to scout. Yeah, ledges.
Yeah.
To scout game trails and game in general. And also, with my experiences, I've had rock clanking from these areas that have lasted over an hour. So to me, it provides not just a vantage point to view the lake, because they're in kind of
like a
valley.
A sentry. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So not only a vantage point, but they provide easy access to rocks. They provide a game trail, and you know, there's many things they provide. And some people have mentioned, you know, I've talked to Tom Powell about this, and he thinks that, you know, they could provide caves. And I haven't really ventured into some of these areas. I'm going to. But maybe caves. And also up here in the area that I go to in Clackamas County, there's a lot of reports of Sasquatch being seen lifting boulders and digging for ground squirrels and mice. So there's a lot of small game there as well.
Yes, there's also a lot of reports, like grizzly bears in the summer will go up into a lot of the mountains too, where there's a lot of that kind of rock. They go under it, and there's moths that lay their eggs in there, and the grubs start to hatch. And there's such a dense amount of protein in one grub for these bears, they just gorge themselves on it because that's a lot of food for their winter. So, again, maybe that's very similar to, in the area as well. You know, maybe there are certain types of moths and stuff that do lay a lot of grub. I don't know what specific type of grub this is, the one that the bears have been feeding on, but can always just check it up online and see, right? And it might apply to the area as well. So, they're, you know, good source of protein that's there. But you're right. Hunters they'll get up there and watch below, and it's easy to traverse across because there's little ledges and stuff. And also, you know, there was a discussion on here about caves and stuff, and I know that they probably use some of the caves, but really when you go inside a cave and you stay in there for any length of time, you see your breath. So I don't think you would be living in there. You'd be freezing your you-know-what off. And so I think rock ledges and stuff are a little more prominent where they can get 2 or 3 feet into where they're out of the weather, but definitely not cold from the whole atmosphere inside a cave, like, you know.
Yeah.
In a cave, you're somewhat trapped, too. I mean, unless you're by the entrance.
Yeah, they'd have to live by the entrance. So I have a tendency that, you know, because they just, they move around and that, and they're just opportunists for looking for, you know, crag trees, and they make their own structures and stuff, a lot of them on the ground. I've seen just, you know, lots of cedar bark pulled off a tree and then piled up like a dog bed, and then they sleep on that. I've seen something like that. I've seen one that looked like it was made out of fern. So whether they stay in a specific area for any length of time, I don't know. But I do know that they make ground nests, and where they primarily live, I don't know. If it's raining out, maybe they have a cave they go and hang in, and when they're traveling, maybe they like sleep under the big trees out here that keep you dry, right?
Yeah,
so every,
you know,
every landscape has its own different, you know, providing means for an animal to what they want to use, you know.
Yeah, and I personally have only come
across... I've heard correlations of granite as well and Bigfoot sightings.
Hmm.
And I know, I think the Texas Wood Ape Agency has a page on their website where they have some correlation to mineral deposits. And,
well, granite
yeah,
is
with them
usually,
it's different.
Yeah. Well,
the
granite
Texas
has
Wood
black...
Ape, I think. I don't know if it was salinity or something, but...
Oh, okay. Well, that could be. But I know that granite, you know, I go out gold panning, you know, the black sand that's in the granite, it's sort of magnetic, right? So that's something
yeah.
to look at, too. You know, stuff like that is also used in modern medicine nowadays for healing, too, right? Magnet.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's always, you know, all these little things to think of.
Yeah, exactly, and mm-hmm. Like you had mentioned before the break, you know, about patterns and looking back in history in these areas and seeing
yeah.
if they go back to these areas year-round or at certain times of the year, you know,
yeah.
it's all about building patterns as far as if you're a researcher, building
yes.
patterns, doing your history and, you know, looking at why is this happening and why is
happening.
This happening in this area.
And when.
And,
yeah.
and when, yeah. And like you
yeah.
mentioned before, too, it's very important to document, you know, whatever is happening, especially in these areas, as far as, you know, is there wind, what time of day it is, you know,
yeah.
what's the moon like. I mean, all this will build a pattern,
yeah.
and you
yeah.
can look at history and kind of make, you know, educated guesses, hypotheses as to
yes.
what to expect or, you know, what's going on.
Yeah, and narrow down your research field so you spend more productive time rather than just fun time trying to be productive.
Exactly. Well, I have a question here. Let me see here. It says, this person says, there seems to be a lot of controversy around Squatch behavior. Is this because we have different species with different levels of intelligence and moralities? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do believe there is different species. Just through the fact of the footprints, when you study footprints from Florida to California to up here, you know, Florida seems there's a little more elongated footprint, and more the toes seem to be more close set like ours. On the island here and in BC, we find, I have found, the footprints are very wide, you know, 7 to 8 inches wide, and some deviation of the big toe off to the side, a bit more ape-like. Pictures from Florida, they show them more like a narrow heel, and the toe arrangement is different again. So, you know, the different species, sure, why not? We have, you know, two or three different species of moose. You know, you start off in the lower, you know, in the United States, and then you come up to lower Canada. You go up to Alaska. There's three species there. The biggest ones are in Alaska. So, yeah, I think that there is a lot of different things going on with the Sasquatch. I wouldn't just put them in one envelope and say that they're all the same. I would say that, you know, a lot of them evolved to the nature that is around them, and then there's some that have more genetic influences, maybe for the environment, and of course they must probably share their genetics too, so they don't become too inbred, you know, that their
right.
their populations start to dwindle from, you know, infocyte and stuff. So those are all different things. So when researchers go out, they should expect something different in their area just because the whole geographical area is different, right? The food is different, kind of thing.
Yeah, you can't really, it's kind of apples to oranges in a lot of these areas to compare something to another state or another region. It can be completely different.
Yeah, it could be. And that's one thing is your history and your details and old stories. You know, start rooting around for stories that were before, you know, regular TV and just radio, because those are ones that are going to give you the most credible details, right? Because they weren't influenced by photographs and movies and stuff like that. Those I find the best to start off on as far as, you know, getting some clear details of what's going on, because it still happens today, right?
Yes, absolutely. Today's generation is influenced by TV and the internet. When they go out to the woods, you know, a lot of times it's kind of like they reach for it to be a Sasquatch before anything else. It's like, oh, that, you know, when in fact it could have been a bear, cougar, a person, or anything else.
They run in front of you, and that's what they do. That 100 years ago in the Cowichan Valley, it was, a gold prospector had seen on the Cowichan River. He's seen a Sasquatch kneeling down, washing these different roots in by hand in the water. And what he described after were skunk cabbage roots. So different things like that. How would he have, you know, come up with that? And that's, I know the bears in the spring when the skunk cabbage comes up, I guess it's, the root is like potato, very starchy, and I know the bears will dig them up and eat them, and they grow in sort of wet areas, low-lying areas.
Mm-hmm.
They're very pretty, they're a very lush-leafed plant, but they stink really bad.
The area I research in, in the early summer months, they're prevalent. They're everywhere, and you do notice that bears do eat them. I mean, it's pretty obvious. You see bear tracks and uproots, and you know, you smell it, and you think, oh, I'm smelling a Sasquatch, when in fact you're just smelling
skunk cabbage.
Or
a bear that rolled in it,
Or rolled in it, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And another thing, too, is you got a lot of medicinal plants, native medicinal plants that people don't even know of. And that's another thing to look at, too, because even the native people, you know, lived off the land and knew what to have and not what to have when they had certain things like stomach ache or a toothache or, you know, just minor ailments that everybody would have whether you lived in a house or out in the bush, right? Mm-hmm. And I look for those areas too, you know, what's more available in certain areas and certain times of the year, because that would also indicate maybe game following that, as well as, you know, the Sasquatch would probably use that to their benefit. So I look for those areas too, like some alpine areas probably have more Sasquatch at a certain time of the year because the roots are, you know, it's cold up there and things are just starting to warm up. So all the grass and that would still be as lush and high of content of vitamins and minerals as it did below in June. So,
right.
You know.
Well, and you're talking about something that lives in the forest and for a long time. And, you know, just like the Native Americans and Aborigines around the world, they know their plants because it's been time and tested, you know. It's something that they've...
Yeah,
and Sasquatch, why would there be a difference as far as knowing what's good and what's bad, you know?
Yeah.
Pretty obvious, you know. But...
If anyone wants to call in, go for it. The number is 347-326-9859 and press 1 to talk.
Yeah, we had a couple of callers earlier. I think they dropped off, but they'll call back.
Okay.
Definitely. I know they had some questions for you, Cindy. Now, Cindy.
Okay.
Here's another question for you, coming from our chat room. Is rock throwing or running in front of cars, are they testing or playing with us, or are they just trying to scare us, in your opinion?
mean in your vehicle out in the bush doing research, or just generally going down the road?
I believe what the guy's asking is, rock throwing, I guess, would probably be if you're camping out, as I've had happen to me. And as far as running in front of cars, I would imagine just your average person driving down the road.
Yeah, I would say that is just, you know, you happen to be Johnny on the spot, and mm-hmm. it was probably coming out of the ditch or it was going to go across anyway. And it's like any animal, and including us, when you get headlights in your face, you can't see where it's crap, right? And then the daytime, they probably just want to get across the road, and you just happen to see them. I don't think if it's a play or any premeditated, gesture on their part that they were doing anything. I think you were just happen to be the guy on the spot.
Yeah.
And the rock
throwing. Yeah,
because
you'd think they'd want to not be seen.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, I think food plays the ultimate role in their life. I mean, they want to be hidden and avoid us at all costs. But if you're a hungry, starving squatch and that deer just ran across the road,
well, that's
you
your
might
whole priority
be,
is to survive.
Following.
And every day you survive,
yeah.
right? Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, they hang out by roads. Well, some of them probably over the years probably have learned that cars kill deer and roadkill is ready available along a lot of those fast roads, busy roads. So,
sure.
yeah, hang
That's
out
like
there
fast
and see
food
what...
for Bigfoot.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I think that, you know, when they do throw rocks, they're not very good aimers. I can say that. I've had several rocks thrown at me over the years, and it's just basically to make a noise. They can't aim or shit.
They might not be trying to hit you either.
No, it's just a scare tactic, or they throw. It's kind of like what we do when we see a rabbit or a squirrel in the bush. What do? We pick a rock and throw it at the thing because we want to see it run, right? So. You know, the same thing. They want to see us run or, you know, observe us, you know, from a distance or see what's going to happen, right? And so, you know, you come running out of your car and yelling at them, and then they probably stand there and watch us to see what we're like, whether we're dangerous or, you know, are we a prey animal or are we an edible animal? So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the few times that I've had rocks thrown at me, mainly been in the early morning hours, and I've been in my tent, and they usually land. They don't actually usually ever hit my tent. It's always been next to my tent. I may still have a little bit of fire going, but it's almost like they're trying to see if you're awake or what's going on, you know, sort of scenario. I mean, that's just what I gather.
Yeah, we do the same thing.
Just
if you were,
you
say,
yeah.
somebody
oh, yeah.
that was in an army and come along across a camp, the first thing you do is you throw in something in there to see if anything stirs and stuff, right? And if not, well, it's good. We can get closer or whatever, right?
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Yeah, I think it's just
okay, well, it looks like that caller called back here.
Okay.
Take
501, you're on Monster X Radio.
Hey, guys, it's Thomas.
Hey, Thomas.
Hello.
Hey.
I was just calling in to out myself that I was the one that asked Miss Cindy about her age. And I'm sorry about that, but the reason I did it is because I was interested in your encounter that you had with such an aggressive display of this whatever was chasing you.
Yep.
Is that... Could he have picked up on your female scent?
Oh, probably, but I was no longer
personal about it. But I'm
No. I know what you're asking. I had a hysterectomy, so that wouldn't have been it. But I don't think that was part of it at the day because, one, it was overcast and drizzly. So if there was any scent, it would have been washed to the ground. So there was nothing carrying through the air, right? So I don't think that was it. I think I was just in the wrong spot at the right time.
The wrong spot at the right time, that's for sure. Well, I've enjoyed listening to you tonight. I'm a big believer in data and research and statistics.
Oh, good.
And so I just hope that more people will follow your lead in that area because... Like, just the stuff that you were talking about, what were the trees like when the encounter occurred? Were they bare? Or did they have leaves on them? You know, every little thing counts.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't pay attention to the time and the date, or they forgot about it. But when they know a genuine story, and in your mind you can recall it, you can tell if there's leaves on the tree or not, because you can recall it type thing. Those little things help them remember.
So that's up in your area. I'm down in the south. I'm not in Boggy Creek, but I'm in Arkansas, and that's where, you know, everybody's Bigfoot fun started back when we were kids.
Yeah.
And I believe that here in the south that they tend to hang around those areas, swampy bottom areas where there's a lot of rain.
Probably more frog and salamander and snake and stuff in that area. Probably a lot of more animals, you know, stay in those areas. Maybe it's cooler because the water is evaporating, causing cooler air in those areas. You know,
exactly.
Those kind of possibilities. Yeah.
Well, I would imagine they say that the fount monster is an aggressive type individual, and if I was covered with hair in the heat of the summer and was getting bit by every animal, every insect, I'd be upset as well.
I agree. But you got a lot of.
I appreciate you taking my phone call. I didn't mean to be so forward, but it was. I'm just trying to think outside the box if that might have been a female squatch that was chasing you.
No. Well, you know what? I can't say yes or no, but what I feel in my heart, you know, like what happened, just the sound itself was so deep that if that was a female, she didn't drop her, you know what, balls. You know, it was way too, it was too masculine sounding for what.
Come rated X tonight.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm forward to that. It's how you get things discussed and talked about, is when you start deviating from what could be a probable cause, then you're not going to get anywhere. I did researching. I just got in this morning from last night and did something very similar to that, what you're talking about.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you taking my phone call.
You're welcome.
Oh, absolutely, Thomas. Always.
All right, y'all have a good night.
You too.
Night-night.
You too, buddy.
All right.
Good stuff.
There's always one that's brave enough to ask.
Yeah. Oh, why not? You know, that's what we're here for.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well,
Keith had a question.
Go ahead.
In the chat room, and he's also on the island. He was wondering, is there a place to send samples for DNA or other things that you know of?
I do hair analyzation right now, but I do not do DNA. That Keith, I ran into him on the island here. Personally, to send DNA samples to, I would send them to Mr. Sykes in England. I think of all the reputable places, I would deal with him, just because he's had the least amount of, you know, talked about or backstabbing and whatever. I would send a sample there, but make sure what you're sending is going to be credible, you know, because 9 times out of 10, a lot of people see a lot of times it's just black bear hair. And that's kind of what I do, and I don't charge. But for me, it's also filling in the blocks of the data of comparison, and I can rule out if it's the neighborhood's dog or if it was a black bear and stuff like that. If there's DNA on that, I can't help you, but I would suggest you sending it to university. Oh, I can't remember the name now. Is in England for Mr. Sykes. That would be the best place to send it. If you think you got a DNA. Now, most of you, do you understand that DNA will come from hair, but only if it's got the round hair bulb on the end that's attached? It's hard to get DNA just from a single hair strand. And they can, if they got, you know, a little clump of 20 or 30 hairs, be able to get some DNA out of it. But most of the DNA is sitting in the skin, or the little funny, when you pull a hair out, you can see a little clear bubble on the end of the hair. That's the important part right there, if you're thinking of DNA. Scat is hard to get DNA from. Lots of times you just get live cells that are shed as the scat is coming out of the body off the intestinal wall. And due to the drying effort of the scat, they die quite readily and very quickly, and therefore losing a big part of the DNA, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not one of the best things for DNA. If anything, it's just nice to have to see what they ate and food and stuff they can, you know, from that aspect. Saliva would be another good one, but you got to, you know, again, use a sterile Q-tip, and not from the ones that you clean your ears. You go to the drugstore and you get a Q-tip or a Q-tip swab that has a wooden handle on it, and it's in a sterile envelope, and it's paper. And when you do any of this stuff for DNA, never put it in plastic. Always paper. Paper envelope, or the swab's in a paper cover. And always let it dry out, no matter what it is. It has to dry. If it's blood, snot, you know, whatever. Make sure it's dry, because the DNA will rot and go moldy, and it'll be useless, right? So.
Yep.
Is that why you don't use plastic? Because the water will stay in there?
Yeah, the moisture deteriorates the DNA. Plus, you got chemicals and plastics and breaks things down, but yeah. Yep, exactly.
Interesting.
Now, Cindy, you just got back from the field. You know, I think you went out Friday or Saturday night, and you know, what happened with you on the field? Whereabouts were you?
We were out towards the west coast, the south end of the island, out by Port Renfrew. We were out in that area, and a couple of weeks earlier had some talking and calls come back in the bush, and we also had recorded some rock throwing and some good would sound like wood knocks after that, just prior to everybody sort of waking up. So it seemed like they could hear the boys rustling around in their sleeping bags and their tents, and all of a sudden this rock came. And, of course, they got a reaction. One of the guys actually kind of sat up in his tent, so you could hear that. And then shortly after, you could hear these very wood knocks on one side of this gravel pit and then on the other at a distance. So it was almost like they were communicating, say, hey, yeah, somebody's, you know, moving around when I threw a rock type thing. Now, I'm just saying that as opinion or supposedly, because I don't know for certain. The game cameras didn't catch any movement. We couldn't see anything, but we definitely heard it, and everybody was sound asleep when this occurred. So, and it was unique because of 8 hours of recording through the night. We had nothing until that moment, and that was at about 5:45 in the morning when that happened. And to last night I was out. We did some calls again in the same area, just a different part of the road, maybe a mile from where we were the last time. We did some different types of calls, more ape-like type of calls, gorilla type of calls. And I also have this robotic chimp that I bought. It's from Japan, and it's a kid's toy. And I cut the eyes out of it, and I put in those little glow sticks you get from the dollar store for kids to play with, and I put the blue glow sticks in behind, in the head, and behind the eyes, and I carried this chimp around and made sort of cooing noises walking down the road with this. And a lady that I know quite closely is going to have a baby here in 3 weeks, or in a couple of weeks, I mean, and her pheromones in her urine would be different while she's pregnant, probably, and so what I was trying to display with that was we scented down the road on cotton swabs that I placed on the road and poured urine on it, and we kept doing this and doing all these calls. So I was hoping to entice a male in the area or another female that might be maternal, that they could visually see me carrying this little baby with the blue eyes glowing. And I also use a red glow stick on my head, indicating me as an adult. And so we did get some calls from about, it sounded like 3 or 4 miles up the valley. But again, too far away to say exactly what it was, but they definitely were different. So, and that's kind of the stuff we do, is we think outside the box. We try little different things like that, like the we're the new gang in the area scenario, like the male challenging the other male for a female. Mm-hmm. That works really well. You know, stuff like that. And so I got to check the game cameras tonight and see what I got on there. And plus we had some out there, and see what happened last night when we all went to bed. You never know.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. You know, do you have any recordings for people to listen to of some of the stuff that you've taken out in the field?
I do have some. Different, like a wood knock occurred, and I did have a nice return call years ago, but it was left on somebody else's recorder and it got deleted. But a lot of these, like the one, the rock and the wood knock I got from last week, I have. So yeah, I could always, if they want to hear stuff like that, I can send it to them.
Okay.
It's just that it's hard because you got the file that you send, right? It's going to be broken up a bit.
Right, but, right.
I don't have any good vocal recordings. I wish I did, like up close and personal. You know, those are hard. You can get the faint ones, and then you know what happened because you can see it on the analyzer. But people that have just listened to it, they're going, "Was that it? What was that?" You know.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So just like every other investigator, I don't always get the good prize either. You have to work for it. And, you know, first thing you do is you pull up is you got your radio on, you got your cameras going, and you hook your parabolic up and drop it off, and then you go about your business because you never know when it's going to happen, right?
Yeah,
that's the first
exactly.
thing I do. And you might record everybody's conversation for the next 10 hours, but you know what? Somewhere along the line, it might just happen.
It's a lot of work, and it's very time consuming to listen to those recordings. It's kind of like gold panning. You pan and you pan and you pan, and you get that little nugget, and it makes it all worth the while. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I'm going to kind of change the subject here. You know, I met you up at the Olympic Project up in Washington, and we had dinner with. Quite a, you know, 15 people or so. You know, Derek Randles was there, and there was a lot of other people. Now, we sat down with the Browns that had part of the Olympic Project now with the thermal video that's out there. And I don't know how much time you actually had to talk with the Browns. I had quite a bit of time to talk with them and interact.
Not a lot, but more than like just meeting them and that, but I think you probably had more in depth. But I tried to talk to them out in the lobby and the foyer and stuff there too. Yeah.
Yeah. What was your impression of them? Because, you know, of course, there's coming out with a thermal video like that and some of the claims that they're claiming. There's always going to be people out there saying they're hoax and this and that. I just, for me personally. I found them to be very credible, very honest, very forthcoming. What was your impression?
I found them to be, I would say, very similar. I got when I met them, they were genuine. They were they acted like they were nothing special, which is good. They weren't looking for high kudos or publicity or photographs. They just want to understand what's going around their place, and they're also, you know, brave enough to step forward and say, you know, we've got something going on, let's work with you guys, or how can we, you know, make them go away or stay around, or what is going on. That's how I felt. They wanted a lot of questions answered, like we do. We get curious. And I do believe some of the photos that I've seen, there with the structures in the bedrooms and stuff like that, I've
mm-hmm.
found very similar or almost identical things here on the island as well. So I know there's not just one person running around out there playing silly buggers with all us and just perhaps to meet up someday to share the same antics of one individual. No, I believe they're very credible. The people that they're working with are very credible. I know them very well. I've been out in the field with them on many occasions.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact they wouldn't put their name on it if they felt the least bit of, you know, any falsehood or hoaxery going on. And I believe what's happening with them is true. It's absolutely
yeah.
true.
Is that on the property they live at?
Yes, that is. Yes, it is. And
what a treat.
It's been going on for a very long period of time. And
right.
I think
exactly.
The property they live on, of course, may have been in the family for a long time, and they are now living there, and now we're sort of doing something about it, or you know, looking into what's been going on, and
right.
that's where I took the idea because she's also pregnant. She just
mm-hmm.
had the baby a couple of weeks ago, so
right.
I've heard that before in other situations where this has been where they're curious. As you know, what's going on? They seem to instinctively know, and we do as other animals. When you got a rounded belly on a gender-specific animal, it usually indicates pregnancy, and you have a tendency to be more gentle and more protective and guarding of that animal, whether it's your species or not. It's just our instinct to be more maternal to something that's pregnant, and I believe that you know. I know your testosterone and your different hormones change during pregnancy and smell, and that's usually through urine that it's more noticed, right? So
right.
that's why I went out with this last night with this idea, because I know that, you know, they seem to be interested in what's going on with her because she is pregnant and she has little kids. So she's
mm-hmm.
a mother or a female figure, and female species of just about any kind is are generally more gentle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Except for hyenas or something.
Yeah.
Generally, a female is more gentle and stuff like that. So easier to approach, right?
Yeah.
Just
to I mean,
genetic. Yeah.
Yeah, this area, you know, that Derek and them are researching and the Browns live on, it has a history. It's got a lot of history to it, and they've had a lot of stuff going on, and they only reached out after a certain amount of time. I really think that they didn't really know where to go, and they found the Olympic Project and
yes.
And reached out to Derek and him, and they brought in their resources like David Ellis with the sound and whatnot, and they really have some really compelling stuff, and they're still
yes.
building upon this. And
yes.
a lot of it hasn't been released to the public. You know, you
no.
mentioned some stuff tonight that a lot of people didn't know about, you know, that I haven't mentioned before, especially with the behavior or possibilities with, you know, the pregnancy and whatnot.
Yeah.
And also with the structures on the property and whatnot.
Yes.
A lot of people don't realize that this is not just this isn't a small area we're talking about. We're talking about a vast area. That
yes.
even David Ellis, with some of the sound recordings that have been up and close,
yes.
there's a lot of recordings that are way off in the distance, you
yep.
know. So there's a lot going on there, and I mean, I'm looking forward
yeah,
to.
Yeah, I'd have to know
Derek
more about those structures because those are pretty
yeah,
common. You know, I can
yeah.
go in local woods here and find structures that look like that that either A are natural or B were made by humans. So you know, it's interesting to know. The details and the other correlations.
Yeah. Well, that's where the, you know, if even taking physics in grade 10 or 12 in school, you start applying that and sort of unravel the structure. Okay, where was the first one and how did that get there? And then all of a sudden there'd be one on top of it and wedged through another tree. So it becomes down to the fact is there's a lot of things that have to be manipulated to get into that position. And when you try to not physically pull it apart, but if you put your hand on it and traced it back, saying, well, I have to go here and go here, but then I'd have to shove this other one under here first. So then the law of physics doesn't even apply, because in order for a tree to fall and land on the other tree like that, they usually fall in a straight line, you know, whether it's sideways or forward or backwards. And once they glance off another tree or a branch, then their direction changes. But some of these things, you know, even defy that, where they glance off a tree, but not only they glanced off it, but they went 90 degrees around the tree and then back around through another tree and then under a couple more. That's what I find. Those kind of nests where even some of the ones that they show are very simplistic, but you can tell that they've been used. But even some of those I have found in inactive bacteria's areas that just... you got no other trees around that are manipulated or placed in that order, and you can go through a stand of forest that's been, you know, planted 50 years ago, all in the perfect rows and that, and all of a sudden you're getting branches and trees in there that aren't even from that forest. They're from an outside a slash or something, and they were brought into that. So I haven't physically visited this area to physically study and look at those, but from the photos I have seen, they're very similar to what I have found. So,
what prompted them to get a hold of Derek in the first place? So they haven't seen one per se, have they? They just had a lot of odd occurrences.
I haven't talked to them in that much detail. Like it's just like they said, the site was very rich with history over the, you know, the family's generations and stuff, and you know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that they've actually had a sighting. They may have. I'm not sure. I can't comment on that. Yeah, I don't know.
No.
I know there's a lot of stuff that's gone on there that hasn't been released to the general public, just because.
Yeah.
They're going about this the right way. They're releasing some evidence, but at the same time, they're not trying to jump the gun,
right,
and give everything away. So there's a lot going on there. I mean, it's a really phenomenal area. They said there's a lot going on there. It's exciting for me and to know Derek and the Living Project and to kind of hear tidbits here and there, but. Just, you know, keep an open mind about it, and we'll see what happens.
Exactly,
you know?
I know a lot of people dismiss it as a hoax right away, and lots of them are people down in Texas that haven't been out in the woods in a year. you know, your opinion is your opinion, but a lot of it's third-party hearsay, and if you're going to jump in on third-party hearsay, well, you know, you're just as much as a hoaxer as the guy that's doing it. I never say 100% I'm sure it's Sasquatch, but I do say that it's very unusual, and I have seen other things that are very similar to that. And and just knowing the people that they reached out to, it's not their style to go out and make a name for themselves just because they want to be known. They are credible people. So when they bring forth a video of something and then they go out of their way to reenactment just to show you, they're not saying it's a Sasquatch and you have to believe me. What they're saying is, this is what we've noticed, this is what's happened, right? And they leave it at that. So they're not, but a lot of people right away just say, oh, it's a hoax, it's a man standing there. And I really find it funny because those are the people that would never come up to you in face-to-face and go out there and prove you otherwise.
Right.
Because, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I talked to the Browns, and they were actually full of questions. They were coming out and saying this, this, and this. They were full of questions. I mean,
yes. They wanted answers.
They wanted answers.
Yeah.
You know, and
even
now, as far as your work with the BFRO goes, is that something where they contact you when they have certain reports in your area, and then you go out and investigate them?
Sometimes they will if someone phones them or emails them. If it's urgent, or they sent a letter to, or something, you know, then I'll get an email immediately saying this just come in, go check it out. But otherwise, most of them go into a database that the investigators log into, and it's a private database, not open to the public. And these are just like it's out of confidence or confidentiality, so people have a place that they can write what they want to write, and it'll say, I don't want the public to know, or I need to talk to somebody, and sometimes they just want to get it off their chest, so they put it in there. And then we go through there, and it's, you know, they're all from different areas, and they're done in states and provinces and stuff, and you can go through there, and if you see something that just happened from an area, you know, 2 days ago that you know of, then, you know, you certainly want to contact the person and get the gist of what they experienced and then start watching the area, right? But the BFRO, like I said, has a database, and it's up to you to use your time to do it. You're not paid a fee or anything. This is all voluntary basis, but they also are very select on who they choose to do this work for them, right? And that's the BFRO. Plus, I do my own research on the side, like the hair and stuff is not BFRO associated. And lots of us just get together and go out and do our own research on the side with our own equipment, too. So, you know.
Cindy,
like
how many?
Doing it, so.
Nice. Yeah, how many BFRO members are on Vancouver Island that you're aware of?
Let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 6 of us.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a drop in the bucket.
Yes. And it's funny because lots of times you will get a phone call or an email or whatever, and then when you contact the people, they'll try to tell you the spot, and you go, yeah, I know, is that beside this and this? And then if it's not a true story, they start backpedaling real fast because they figure that they found the ultimate spot, and most of us have probably been there at once upon a time or another. So, yeah.
Yeah, you don't jump at every report.
And how many sightings are in the BFRO database for Bigfoot on that island?
On the island here?
Oh, man.
Oh, a couple hundred.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's true, not every sighting and every report, you know, it can be just they heard a noise or, you know,
they do
they
Canada,
see
don't they? On their map?
What?
On the BFRO sighting database map, they have Canada as well as U.S., don't they?
Yeah.
Okay.
We give a very general location. We don't give a specific location because we don't want people that have given us their word that, you know, they've had something on the edge of their farm that all of a sudden 100 people show up there wanting to know where this Bigfoot is, right? So we, you know, a lot of people say, well, this is not the exact area. No, we try to give a general area, like maybe 100 miles or something like that. It's just out of respect for the people that actually, you know, have a sighting and stuff like that, that they're not disturbed or they don't want to be, you know, prodded and poked and everything else.
Do you have any out of the many reports and encounters that you've taken in? What is one of the ones that stood out to you the most?
The one that stood out to me the most was. What I had, I think the second or third one I ever done was up in northern BC, Alberta. It was up on a confluence of two rivers. I think it was Peace River, and so I can't remember the other river. It was a lady who was in her late 50s, and her story was unique in a sense that she had talked a little bit on her story but left a lot of details out, so when I phoned her she had more details, and it was unique as that when she was younger at about 18 she had gone out to this it's like a picnic area for the daytime, and it overlooked this confluence of the Peace River, and they used to have a statue there. An old gold pattern, I can't, something about something Henry, I can't remember his last, it's been a while for all the particular, anyways, it was a tribute to this gold pattern guy, and they had outdoor washrooms and stuff, and her boyfriend and her were up there enjoying the day or the sun, anyways, it was about 7 o'clock at night, they were just getting ready to leave, she was going to use the washroom, And as she was heading to the toilet, the outside toilet, she thought she had seen a grizzly standing on 2 feet behind the toilet. And I said, what made you think that? And she said, because the toilets back then were all the same height. They were generically made for parks and services, and they were approximately 7 feet tall. This thing was taller than 7 feet because it was standing right behind it, and I seen it, and it was kind of reddish. And so when she seen that, she goes, no way she's going to go pee. So she turned around, and just as she turned around to walk, to her boyfriend was getting the car. He was right there with the car, and he swung open the passenger door on his side and told her to hurry up and get in and do not look behind you. And she thought that was odd. And of course, when don't look behind you, what do? You want to look behind you. And this supposedly grizzly bear was 3 to 4 feet behind her with its nose in the air, and she looked it straight in the eyes, and she said it wasn't fur, it was hair, and it was not a bear. It had a flat nose, and the hair was coppery color, the eyes were white and had coppery color pupil, and it looked like a child with its bum in the air, so straight-legged at the back and its hands on the ground. She said it was awkward looking. And she jumped in the car, and when she jumped in the car, this thing started yelling at them like it was just awful. And it stood up, and then it came down, and it slapped its hand on the ground, and it stood up, and it came back down, and it slapped its hand on the ground again. And they were getting the hell out of there. They were driving.
Yeah.
And she said the last time they heard this thing yelling at it. And just her description, when I talked to her, this lady started crying telling me this story, because she says, I can still see the whole thing to this day. And her mother was in her 90s, and her mother was there, and I talked to her mom, and she said my girl was so afraid. She says her and her boyfriend both said the same story. Her boyfriend is dead now, but her mother identified her story for me as well. And this woman was so upset that she phoned me the next day after she had told me her story and thanked me for listening to her and not judging her, because she hadn't told anybody but her mom and her boyfriend that's passed away what happened that day, and she needed some closure. So some people are very traumatically affected by some of these experiences they have, right? But that was the most resonating one. The description of the animal is crazy. Like, the hair was sparse on the shoulder, and you could see the elbow, and you could see, like, the skin, she said, was like a dark red skin or a dark brown skin. And she said, you know, you could see some of the teeth, but she didn't say whether they're pointed or anything. But this thing was sniffing the air behind her, and she just happened to be menstruating that day.
Okay. Wow.
So, yeah. So that's another one of those scary things.
Well, yeah. No, Cindy, that's awesome. We have a couple minutes here. Real quick, what do you have planned for the future, and what would you like to see come from researchers or the Bigfoot community in general? I mean, what have you got planned, and, you know, what excites you about the future?
Myself planned, I'm going on more expeditions. I want to try to get down to Denver, Colorado in July. I want to try that one. I just am persevering more. I like the field work and keeping on with that. Like I said, I started doing a study of hair analysis. I do have a background in animal sciences. I studied for a veterinarian assistant, and I've taken biology and stuff through college, and through life I've raised animals and trained horses and stuff, and still do. But that's my avenue, is getting more into the scientific end of it that I can afford, which is the microscopic end with the hair. I find that very intriguing for myself. We always want to get, I would like to get a habituation site and study that as to what they eat, and how often and when do they hang around habituation areas? Is it in the wintertime? Is it a year-round? Is it once a week? Those kind of things. Those are the little answers that we need, and we need people to share those. So it would be nice to eventually have a database where anybody interested can start plopping in all this stuff. And like you mentioned, is that eventually we start getting, you know, a clear picture of where to find these animals, protect these animals, and study from afar of these animals, and finally get them recognized. That's my goal. Yeah.
Thank you, Cindy, for joining
us
tonight.
For joining us.
You've been a great guest. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. And sometimes I hope that I have a positive a word or two for somebody, and take what you want and leave the rest.
Absolutely. We hope to have you on the show down the road here. And like I said, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks, everyone in the chat room. Good night, all.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.